Continuing historical narrative that, of course, begins in Genesis in the Garden of Eden and continues as God describes his relationship to man and to this created world. And one of the most important things we learn from the Old Testament is the nature of our God, the kind of God that we have who rules over us. We have this long recorded history of God interacting with his people. And that helps, I think, so much in our understanding who God is and his attitude toward sin and evil and his blessings upon the righteous, his care and love for those who serve him, and the fact that he will always stand up and fight for his people as they seek to serve him. But all through this, we're also seeing God working toward the ultimate aim of all that he's doing, and that is the redemption of mankind. And as we go through the narrative, we see him giving us hints or foreshadowings of things to come, particularly in the prophets we see that. But even in these narratives, as we look back at them, knowing what he did in Christ, we can see the foreshadowing of what he was doing and what he was pointing toward and all that he was trying to accomplish. So these narratives, as we look at them, are not just interesting histories of the Jewish people. They're rather part of a continuing thread of God revealing himself to man all the way through this time of ancient history. And that's very important for us to remember, that although we look at some of the great stories of the Old Testament, like today we'll look at David and Goliath, that's more than just a fascinating story for our children to read in Bible class. It is rather a revelation about the very nature of the man that God saw as a prototype of the one who would be the Messiah, and that is David. And we see the role that he plays then in this history as we go through it. So think of this narrative not as just an interesting story to read. It is that. But it is a part of this continuing revelation of God to man, of his continually working with his people, always at work with his people to accomplish his purpose and to accomplish his plan. This is what he's trying to do. Something else that's very interesting also about the narrative is the time period from which it comes. We're looking at a narrative that's taking place in the 11th, 12th centuries BC. And when you look at other historical narratives or records that we have from that time, one thing stands out about this narrative, and that is the richness of this narrative. It sets itself apart from all the other writings of that time period from other kingdoms and other histories. It is remarkably rich in detail and in all the characters that are involved and how the story continues. It's not, as I say, just a collection of stories someone put together, but it is a continuing saga where you'll read about characters these chapters we'll look at now that'll show up again many chapters later. I mean, it's all tied together. It's like almost like a tightly written novel by a man that who had his plot laid out and knew where he was going and put all the characters in place. That's exactly what you have here as you look at this. So read it from that standpoint and understand that God is going somewhere with this story and in this work that he's doing with these people. And we're coming to a very critical point in the history of what is happening here. God has made a covenant with these people at Sinai. And we're seeing him fulfilling this covenant as these people seek to serve him or seek not to serve him. Because he had told them at Sinai, now if you serve me, here are the things that I'll do. I'll bless you. If you don't serve me, here are the curses that will come upon you. And you can go back in Deuteronomy 28 and 29 and read all about that. And you can even find, interestingly, in Deuteronomy 28, where Moses even makes reference to the fact that they're going to have a king down the road. He told them that at Sinai, that a king that you will request or that you will want will rise up. And then he talks about how they will be carried off into captivity hundreds of years before it happens. But he makes that covenant with them. And really what we're seeing in this narrative is God fulfilling his covenant just as he promised. Blessings as they obeyed, cursings as they disobeyed. And God accomplishing his purpose in all of that. So, with that background, we come to this incredibly important character in the history of God's plan, Old Testament history, and that is David. And his account covers the rest of 1 Samuel and into 2 Samuel as one of the truly significant, most significant characters in Old Testament history. So let's begin to look at the story of David. Who actually is the spiritual leader in Israel at this point? It's not Saul. Yeah, it's still Samuel, isn't it? Samuel is still the spiritual leader, even though Saul has become king. Samuel's the last judge. They're still looking to Samuel as a spiritual leader. And even as we saw earlier, he's not hesitant to challenge Saul on occasion, as he did with what he did in with the Amalekites, when he failed to destroy all the Amalekites as God had told him to do. Samuel does not hesitate to challenge Saul and to tell him that God has rejected him from being king. We have all of that narrative, and when we come to chapter 16, then we see now that God is taking his plan the next step forward. He is selecting the one who will become king. So does David immediately become king after this incident? No, it's going to be a while, isn't it? Exactly. Even though we see that Samuel anoints him, he does not become king for some time yet. And we have this record of this interchange between he and Saul, this contrast between the two. And the difference in the character of the two becomes very important to the narrative. As we understand, I think, what God is trying to show us. Did Saul look the part of a king? What did they say about him? Yeah, fair to look upon. He was head and shoulders above all the other men. He looked the part. Everybody said, yeah, that'll be our king. And they did respond to him. He had an early victory, and they responded to him, and they started to follow him. But his character flaws begin to show. And so we come to chapter 16, after God has rejected Saul, and we begin to see what God now is looking for in his king. It's like he's trying to teach them a lesson with Saul. That, all right, you see what you think a king ought to be. Now I want to show you the kind of man that I want to be king. And this is what we have happen then in chapter 16. Who is David's father? All right, and what's David's main line of work at this point? All right, he's the shepherd. I kind of get the feeling as you read the story that, he's the youngest of, how many brothers does he have? He has 7 brothers, 8 of them in all. And he's the youngest, that he's low man on the totem pole. He has to go out and keep sheep. That's probably not the most desired job at that point. So the youngest boy is out keeping sheep. He has 7 older brothers. We'll see a little later in the narrative, 3 of them actually will be in Saul's army as they fight against the Philistines. But at this point, God comes to Samuel, speaks to Samuel, and tells him where to go to find the king that he's going to provide. And he sends him, as we see in chapter 16, to Jesse the Bethlehemite. I've provided me a king from among his sons. So God knows exactly who he has selected to be king. And he sends him down to Bethlehem, which of course in the New Testament is referred to as the city of David. And there he goes to the house of Jesse to select the men. So as this narrative continues, we see all the sons come before Samuel. And who did Samuel think was going to be king from what he saw? Right off the bat, who came through first? All right, the oldest son comes through, and he said, oh, yeah, that's him. That's the guy right there. And God says, don't look on his countenance. Don't look on the height of his stature. I've rejected him, he says in verse 7. For the Lord does not see man as a man sees, for man looks on the outward appearance, but Jehovah looks on the heart. And we have that statement in Paul's sermon in Acts 13:22 about David being a man after God's own heart. This is what it's about. And in the narrative, again, he's saying to us, here is how God looks for a king. This is the kind of man that we look for. And as we trace David's character here early on, we see amazing maturity. We see great courage. He's obviously a charismatic young man who is bold in his faith and his belief in God and his trust in God and belief that God is with him, and the people respond to him greatly. So as the narrative goes here, verse 10, Jesse made 7 of his sons to pass before Samuel. Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." And Samuel said unto Jesse, "Are these all your children?" He said, "Well, there remains yet the youngest. Behold, he's keeping the sheep." It's like Jesse said, "Couldn't be him. He's the baby. You know, you're looking for a king to lead the people." And he says, "You know, you bring him in." And he brings him in, and he anoints him king. And it says, "And the Spirit of Jehovah came mightily upon David from that day forward," in verse 13. So Samuel rose up and went with him. Now, the reference to the Spirit of the Lord here and in the next verse indicates who God is with. The Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David, verse 14. The Spirit of the Lord, or of Jehovah, departed from Saul. An evil spirit from Jehovah troubled him. There is a shift here in who God is with and what is happening. I don't know that I can explain. Well, I know, okay, I just say I can't explain exactly what is involved in the Spirit of the Lord coming upon David and it departing from Saul, except to say there seemed to be a sense in which the Spirit of God was upon the kings of Israel that served God. That this is not the only place this is referred to, about the Spirit of God being with king. And in what way, in what nature, I do not know. But it does say that it was no longer with Saul, and that there is even an evil spirit. That word evil can be translated many different ways. It can be translated restless. It can be translated troubled. And the idea that I think God put a miraculous evil spirit in Saul, I'm not sure that's what it's saying here at all. But that Saul is having to deal with his own sin, his own conscience. God is dealing with him in that matter in different ways. And whatever comes upon him here is manifested in a mental state in David that is almost like a man who's losing his mind at points. He raves. He cries out. He has these horrible bouts of anger. The wall of his palace ends up with several holes in it, as you may remember, from him throwing his spear at David. He becomes a man who obviously is not of the mindset or the ability to rule a nation. Things are shifting, but during this time, David is being placed in a position to gain the favor and the confidence of the people and become the next leader. This is what we see developing in the text as we go through this. So, this evil spirit from Jehovah troubles him, verse 15. How do his servants try to solve this? What do they tell him? Yeah, okay. You need some guy to play some music for you, kind of calm you and soothe you. We know about this young man. And they tell him about this young man, son of Jesse, verse 18, skillful in playing, mighty man of valor, mighty man, a valiant man, wise or prudent in speech. He's good looking, the Lord is with him. So he sends for him, and David comes, and David is skilled with the harp, and he comes, and he plays for Saul. And it says in verse 21, David came to Saul and stood before him, and he loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. So there is here a picture in that verse that I just read of a relationship developing with him. It becomes kind of a love-hate relationship. There's times when he's favorable toward David and times when he's not. He's ambivalent about this whole thing. He can see the character and the goodness of this young man. At the same time, he feels threatened by him as he becomes this great mighty man of war, leading the soldiers and the people responding to David's victories in battle, and he becomes jealous of him. And so there's this ambivalent attitude that he has toward him that finally becomes a hatred. But in the beginning, there is a respect for him. There is a love for him in the beginning. Saul responds to David apparently like everybody else does. Everybody loves David. David is just this remarkable, charismatic individual that everybody responds to. And the same happens with Saul. But it does not last. And the problem is not David. It's clearly Saul. This is who is struggling. This is who is fighting the battle. I want us to take a minute and kind of get an idea of the setting of... I'm not getting these slides up. Can you get them up for me? I'm not getting them up. There we go. Okay, here we go. I need my pointer. Let's look at the areas we're talking about here. Here's Jerusalem right here. Here's Bethlehem right here. If I can hold that a little steadier. There we go. Right there's Bethlehem. Most of what we're going to look at here, and I want to enlarge this is the area where most of what we'll be talking about in these chapters takes place. I've zoomed in on this. Here's the Dead Sea here. Again, here's Bethlehem. Here's Jerusalem. Ramah. Where Samuel is from is from up in here. I don't think it shows on that map. It's not on either one of these maps, but it's up in this area here. Interestingly, Samuel's grave is one of the archaeological sites that archaeologists are probably most certain about. Pam and I visited the place of his grave. And it's interesting in that it's down in a basement area. And they're quite, as I say, archaeologists, this is one of the sites they feel most certain about, that this really is the grave of Samuel. And the bottom, the basement, is a Jewish synagogue. It's held as a Jewish synagogue. The second level is a Christian church. Then there's a third level, which is a mosque. And this is one of the few places in Palestine where they coexist, because they all honor this place in different ways. But Samuel is this character that was greatly revered by the people himself. And the place of his life, the school of the prophets, the place of his death, pretty well certain about where all those things are. And in fact, around his place of death, I should have put these pictures in, I'll try to do that next time, but are excavated buildings, which they think very well could have been the school of the prophets around where he lived there in that area. Samuel continues to play in this story. But what we will see is battles taking place. Here is the area where the Philistines are and the five cities of the Philistines. Philistines were a part of what were referred to as the Sea People, several tribes that apparently came into the area and are still thought to be the ancestors of some of the inhabitants of the land. If I pronounce Philistines a little different, you might get the idea of where they think some of the ancestry came from. I called them Philistines or Philistinians, Palestinians. Some believe that they are part of the ancestry of many of the modern Palestinians is rooted in Philistine history, which is interesting. That wouldn't be all the explanation of the roots of the Palestinians, but they think that is tied to it, and that the words are very similar for that reason. But we deal with them here, and of course they are a major part of the story during the time of Saul and David. David is the one who finally subdues the Philistines, And after David is through with them, then they are not a major player in history after this. Their name continues to appear some in the history of the kingdom, but they are not the major player that they were early on during this area. In this map, we can see some of the things that were going on. We'll have reason to refer to this map. I should have enlarged it because it's kind of hard to read here. But the battle and the Valley of Elah, the Vale of Elah, between David and Goliath takes place out west of Bethlehem, right down in here. You see, between Philistia and what was at that time Judea, down in this area. This is where that's going to take place. Saul's early victory that really solidified him as king took place up here against the Ammonites in this area. So, again, most of what we're dealing with right in this area here, and we'll talk about some of these other areas also. So we're looking now in chapter 17 of them arrayed against the Philistines down in the Vale or the Valley of Elah. And as we look at that story, we see something unique about what is going on there. Do they just line up and just go to battle against each other here? What do the Philistines do? They have a champion, yeah. And historians tell us this was not an uncommon thing, that this happened on more than one occasion, where armies would put up their best fighter against the other and place the battle in their hand, so to speak. Now, the Philistines were pretty confident about theirs. Why were they so confident about this guy? Yeah, he's a pretty good-sized guy. The best we can determine, probably about 9.5 feet tall. Said his spear was like a weaver's beam. You ever seen a weaver's beam? You know, making carpets, huge things. The heavy weight of the head of the spear, all his armor, all this. He just, obviously, a remarkable specimen. And obviously a man who's never lost, or he wouldn't be out there. No one has ever defeated Goliath. So he stands as this great champion, and he comes out every day, and he mocks Israel, and he mocks Israel's God. And the Israelites are in fear this whole time of the idea of going up against this man, and nobody does it. So this part of the narrative is God introducing David as a great warrior. Not only a great warrior, but a man of tremendous faith. Because what gives him the courage to go up against Goliath is his faith. He can tell Saul about his exploits. When he tried to convince Saul to let him go out there, what did he tell him about? Yeah. Yeah, he said, bear, lion come against the sheep, I'd take care of him. He even described him, said, I'd take it by the beard and kill it. That's a pretty brave guy. So he has the courage, but the confidence he has is because of his faith in God. And the reason he wants to go against Goliath, very important in here, is because he sees God's name being reproached. Look down in verse 26 of chapter 17. And David spoke to the man that stood by him, saying, what shall be done to the man that kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Take away the reproach. This man, this army, is dishonoring God's people. That's what disturbs him. That he is humiliating God and his people. And so it is David who says, God will be with me. I can stand up against this man. In fact, I'm sure in his thinking, any of you could, if you have the faith and the courage to go out there to stand against this man, because God stands with us. This is the attitude that all the army lacked, that David had. And you've got to think about the effect it had upon the army in their view of David after what happens in the story, which we all know. We all know the story well. that not a man in that army was willing to challenge Goliath. Not a single one. None of the great mighty men of valor would go out against Goliath. They tried to stop David from going. Saul tried to put David's armor, Saul tried to put his armor on David, and David said, I can't prove this. I can't do this. I don't need this. And he goes out in full faith and confidence that God is with him, and he takes the weapon that he is most familiar with, his sling and those five stones. And the picture, look in verse 48. And it came to pass when the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David hastened and ran toward the army to meet the Philistine. There's no fear here. When he sees Goliath, he heads for him, straight for him, running for him. And David put his hand in his bag and then from it a stone and slung it and smote the Philistine in the forehead. The stone sank into his forehead and he fell upon his face to the earth. It's an amazing display of courage. He obviously is very accurate with the slingshot too, that he could do that. Stones usually a pretty good size, about like that they said they were using these slings. The slings consisting of a patch of material with four strings coming off of it, that two tied together at each end, and he would hook fingers in it, place the stone in the sling and get it up to full speed, and then he would let one side of it go and sling the stone and hit him straight in the forehead. It says it sank into his forehead, so it cracked his skull, obviously knocked him unconscious, and David gets up on him, kills him, cuts his head off. And it's all over. And of course, as the story continues, the Philistines flee, they pursue them, and then there's this interesting exchange at the end of chapter 16. Let me find that. Excuse me, not 16, I mean 17. Verse 55, and when Saul saw David go forth against the Philistine, he said unto Abner, the captain of the host, Abner, whose son is this youth? And Abner said, as my soul lives, O king, I cannot tell. And the king said, inquire whose son this young man is. And as David returned from the slaughter of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. You see him walking in. He's got Goliath's head in his hand. Saul said to him, who are you, you young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse the Bethlehemite. How do we explain this? I mean, didn't he know who David was already from the narrative? What do you think's going on here? I mean, he's already been playing for him. He's been in his court. Okay, nobody's going to take a shot. I don't know that we have a full answer. Here's my explanation for it. Yes, David has been in. Yes, he's known about David. But he hadn't known this David. Who are you? He's the son of Jesse. Unbelievable. Yeah.
There's sometimes you meet people and you think of them as put them in a box and think this is who they are. And then when they do something that surprises them, and they're probably just shocked.
Okay. What's the main thing David's done for Saul to this point? Played the harp, you know, probably behind a curtain somewhere in the throne room. But suddenly now he sees what's going on, and he is amazed at this young man. So I don't think he's asking necessarily just the physical identity of him. But he's coming to realize this is somebody I really didn't know or understand. This may be part of what's going on here. Who is this man? Some try to make the explanation that it has to do with Saul's mental state, that when he's in these rages, he really doesn't know who's around him, and he didn't pay that much attention to David before this point, and now he sees him. There are different explanations that could be offered. But it's obvious that in the narrative, David is rising to the top now. And Saul is seeing him in a totally different light as God takes his man and places him before the people, preparing him to be their leader. This is how the narrative is advancing itself. Okay. Well, any other thoughts or comments, questions? Janelle? I think that's a great point. The narrative is rich enough and full enough to see why Saul ended up the way he did and to illustrate the character of David in contrast to that. Saul did not deal with challenges and trials well. David did not back down from them, but with full faith and trust in God, went forward doing what he knew to be the will of God. Saul, as you say, on occasion would trust himself. He could be impatient. He could lose his temper. He could do a lot of things that were not good for a ruler. And we see that in the narrative. It's rich enough and full enough that we can see that develop. And in contrast to that, we see the character of David. What a great young man he is, the exceptional young man he is. And that God is teaching us this lesson, as you say, about the kind of heart he wants to be his servant, the kind that can serve him most faithfully. So, what happens in the next two chapters? Any other comments or questions on that? Yes.
I see it differently from what you said, because I know in the New Testament it talks about when God sends them a deluding spirit and he grows and why those who are disobedient. And so when I was looking at this where it said God sent this evil spirit, it was starting to wonder what is that meant? What would be the purpose of it? And then when I thought about that too, I was thinking the consequence of that was that now Saul's starting to act like a lunatic. Okay? Passions are all out of whack. And then eventually all of his support, his respect, the people who are looking upon him, people in his army, now they see, you know, you're acting like a madman. I'm not going to go and do this. And so then he is diminishing in the eyes with David and starting to rise in the eyes of everybody. So I'm seeing that evil spirit helps people to know when to like David as the man. So now we're not looking upon this one in the statue of all this. Now we're looking on this other man, this small person who had this faith that, you know, like when Jesus says,
yeah, well, I don't think really what the two of you are saying are that different, but I think what we have to be careful about not saying is that God made Saul sin. I believe that Saul was still a person of free will and free choice. The evil spirit, whatever that is that comes upon him, doesn't come upon him until he has failed God and sinned against him and failed to correct that. This is when the evil spirit comes upon him at that point. So it's a consequence of his own actions. But it's clear that in some way God is playing in this story. And like I said, I don't understand all that's involved here in the spirit of God being upon David and the evil spirit being upon Saul, except to say that God was showing his disapproval for Saul, his approval for David, that this is the role he's going to play now, and that they do stand in tremendous contrast to one another as we follow the narrative, and that God is, and again, always remember this as you read this narrative, it is not just an interesting collection of Jewish tales. It is a tightly knit historical narrative directed by the Spirit of God, revealing God's hand at work in all these people's lives. And it is sad to see what happens to Saul. I mean, it is. That he is so, a man who has so much opportunity and throws it all away. It is sad to see. And I think the important thing to get here is the contrast between the two. That this is what we see, this tremendous contrast between the two. And God, with this one who is seeking to serve him and has rejected this one who has been disobedient unto him and failed him as a ruler. Well, the next two chapters develop the story of David and Jonathan. This bond that develops between the son of Saul and David. Even though Saul has totally rejected David, Jonathan finds this closely knit bond with David. And they love each other as brothers. And it almost becomes a tragedy as we follow this narrative from this point forward. Because of what finally happens to Jonathan and the relationship between David and Jonathan. And how Jonathan is torn between his father and David. That struggle that goes on there. How he wants to believe his father. And yet David says, listen, here's the way it is. Really, that's what you see in the narrative as you follow it. But we'll pick up some on that. But I really want to go ahead and get into the next section. Which is lesson 4, the decline of Saul and the rise of David. We'll spend a little bit on 18 through 20 and get on into 21 on Wednesday night, okay?